Years and years ago, I was living in Pittsburgh when Three Mile Island happened.
Yeah.
And my mother would call me about every 45 minutes or so, and I could tell from her voice she was like anticipating that the call would end in a high-pitched whine or something. She didn't ask anything, we didn't say anything, she just called back an hour later. Anyway, well, I just wanted to get together primarily because when we met just before the opening of the session, I got an opportunity to outline the agenda, and I promised some effort to try to sit down midway or so through, and if you wanted, even at the end, to see how the pieces look when they hit the ground. So I don't have much more of an agenda other than to share some sense of where we stand and let your questions take us wherever. Where do we stand? I guess the only thing that can be said is this is a game that doesn't work itself out until the final 3 minutes, and you don't win it until then, but you can lose it at any point along the way, and we haven't lost it yet. So what you can say is we are right where you could hope to be, but the last 3 minutes will tell. There were three parts to our agenda. Well, two large ideas that sort of cloaked the agenda, authority and accountability. The big idea being that to have accountability without authority, to ask people to perform without the wherewithal to perform, was unreasonable. But to have authority without accountability, to confer authority without the accountability, was irresponsible. And so you needed both, and you needed to move both along together, that one without the other actually doesn't succeed. So we put together a package of bills sort of under those two broad headings. Under the authority piece, there are two significant measures. They have been moving along, and they are positioned pretty much where we would hope that they, where we could hope that they would be. The first is a fiscal authority piece. It's a measure to give the education system authority over certain elements of its fiscal affairs that it has not had. Specifically, what it does is this, and actually on this front there has been progress beyond progress through the legislative progress, through the legislative process. There has been progress in terms of expanding even and selling the agenda. When we first went to the governor and explained what we wanted to do and why, the basic idea being that you will never grow resources for education as long as the education budget exists throughout the entire year in a zero-sum compensatory relationship with all of the rest of the state's obligations. As long as the general fund allocation is not a dependable base budget, then new monies, when they are received, are not additive necessarily, and you don't grow resources for education. And that's the situation that we've had. Typically what happens when we get federal money, private philanthropic money, corporate contributions or whatever, we petition for and get permission to spend that money when it comes in. And why wouldn't you? It's money from outside. But that money is also then offset with a restriction of general funds allocation, and the net is essentially zero sum. It's actually a little worse than that, because if you get a grant to develop an ocean studies curriculum, you also then get an obligation to deliver an ocean studies curriculum. So the grant comes with money, but the money is clearly dedicated to a work scope. What gets restricted is general fund support to schools, non-specific support. So in a very real sense, you end up behind by assuming the responsibility to develop some curriculum or whatever it is that that the grant might have been supporting. So that's basically an intolerable situation. And we went to the governor, we laid that out. What we petitioned his support for was a bill that would allow the department to accept without restriction outside monies, including private philanthropic, corporate revenues, and federal funds. He was comfortable with all of that except for the federal funds. And so he supported a bill that said, in effect, thou shalt not restrict what we call trust funds, which are that whole collection of things, private, philanthropic, and so on. Thou shalt not restrict trust funds when they are received. And the other piece of it is, thou shalt not restrict the general fund out of consideration for trust funds when they are received. Since then, we've continued to work with the governor, and he has come to agree with us that two types of federal funds, at least, specifically impact aid and Department of Defense reimbursement funds, and the two of them really are analogous programs, that those two funds should come under the same authority protection. And so the bill has been expanded to include, in addition to the trust funds generally, federal monies from impact aid and Department of Defense. That'll be a very good news to our delegation in Washington, who has worked very, very hard to try to get Hawaii preferential treatment in terms of the funding formula for impact aid, but has found that to be very difficult, because while there is sympathy and there's good cause for Hawaii to have a special weighting in that formula, unfortunately, the folks in Congress know well this offset problem, and they've tended to react poorly because they see impact aid as support to education, support to schools. And so to hear that it arrives in Hawaii and ends up in the general fund, not education, has really deteriorated their support elsewhere in Congress. So this will be very, very good news to them, too, to have things sheltered by law in that way. In addition, one last thing, that fiscal authority bill also gives the department the authority to manage resources, including reallocation, to manage resources in certain ways that schools have the authority, but the department, interestingly, does not. It just basically makes the argument that that which is necessary to run a school effectively clearly is similarly necessary for the system as a whole. The system to this point has not had the ability to roll over monies, and that means you're unable to plan beyond 1 year at a time effectively for program implementation. We do not have the ability to reallocate monies across program allocations, and that means you cannot examine programs, determine which ones fit with the agenda, and reallocate resources or redirect resources. So the bill also confers that authority. Seems reasonable to us, and as I said, up to the minute at least, things are moving exactly as you'd want them to. The second big piece under authority is, call it administrative authority, to give the department the authority to administer, to manage its own administrative affairs, including organization, definition of the work of various units, determining how that work is done, job titles, job descriptions, et cetera, et cetera. There are interesting stories from virtually every day of employment since I arrived, but the fact of the matter is, what they all add up to is the department lacks, in fact, the authority to manage its own administrative affairs. When I came in and we established the standards agenda, we knew very well that schools were going to need certain kinds of support, including human support, technical support. How do you take the standards and translate them into curriculum? How do you develop standards-based instructional units? How do you develop, apply, and work with new kinds of assessment so that you can monitor children's progress towards the standards on an ongoing basis? We knew that people would need professional development and support in all of those areas, and we identified a role group that was really quite right to dedicate to that work. Unfortunately, we then learned that their job titles, their job descriptions, their location of employment were all written into law at that time. And so, you know, generally all I can say is in the business world, they speak of fast companies, companies that are able to change their shape, change their mode of operation so as to respond to changing conditions and so as to better serve. And the idea is that those that will thrive will be the fast companies and other companies will not. And clearly we will not have a public institution of this size as a fast company as long as it cannot even determine a job title or the work scope, as long as it cannot even, you probably heard this story, I won't retell it, as long as it cannot even determine whether or not a storeroom continues to serve as the best way of delivering supplies, so forth and so on. And at this point, we can't. So the second big piece looks at administrative authorities. This one is very, very difficult. but I think we've got a solution for the time being. Not a final solution yet, but a solution for the time being. It's difficult because there are two approaches that can be taken. We can either do what I call the roadblock clearing approach, which is identify all the problems and remove them. There are two difficulties with that. The first is no one seems to be able to get their hands on or to enumerate an exhaustive list of the roadblocks, because every day you come to work, you discover kind of a new one. The second problem is that the folks around me, and increasingly even me, we're very poor identifiers of roadblocks because people have been living with them for so long. They don't see them, they've learned how to move around them, and what you have to do is challenge people, for example, that 6 weeks to get that accomplished is just simply unreasonable. I know you figured out how to get it accomplished because that law is in the way, but that's not the point. So the roadblock removal approach is one way, but it has those difficulties. The alternative is what you might call the Declaration of Independence approach, just pass law that confers authority, confers freedom. Two problems with that. The first is people are inordinately leery of giving anybody authority here, which is interesting. Nobody likes the current distribution of authority, but nobody has the courage to undertake its redistribution, because that's even scarier. And so you get this situation where nobody likes it, but at least it's what we're used to. And so when we floated sort of the Declaration of Independence approach, the response was, that's not happening, because that leaves very unclear what all you may be able to do as a result. So what we then did was we tried to articulate, okay, authority in these certain areas and with these limits. My thought was clearly nobody's going to bite for this unless we identify the areas of authority, unless we set up limits and people can agree that those limits are reasonable. So we took that approach, and that's what's actually in the bill now, and it's getting a much better reception. The scary part is that it turns out, this is just something that I was too naive to realize, but it turns out that the way you affect that in law is by going through all of the law and removing all the roadblocks. So you do the you can do a Declaration of Independence, but you see what we ended up with was a nice three-page statement of authority and constraints. And then when people started doing the actual work, this thing grew and grew and grew, and it got to be a lot like the Civil Service Reform Bill, at least in density. And so, you know, that sort of bogged it all down. So where it is now, and my impatient side is less than wildly enthusiastic about this, but it's probably the way it'll get accomplished, so patience. What we have now is a bill that defines the areas of authority, reasonable limits to it, and sets up a group to go through and confer authority in those areas by agreement as matters arise, and in fact enumerate them so that we can go back next session and do the cleanup activity. And that's where you'd like it to be. Although interestingly enough, its language scares the devil out of folks in a year of civil service reform, because it says something like this group will remove all rules, regulations, policies, and procedures. And it's real interesting. As I say, no one here likes all the rules, regulations, policies, and procedures. It just turns out that the only thing that's scarier is not having them. You know, so folks have been sort of a bit up in the air around that, and it's still sorting itself out. That's the authority side. On the accountability side, it really is fairly easy to describe where we are. We put in a bill. The bill is an enabling bill in the sense that it confers the authority to establish an accountability system. It does set up the parameters of an accountability system, what things it needs to attend to and focus on. And it also has in it one clause, one sentence, that has become the lightning rod issue around accountability. It was introduced with a sentence that reads something very close to the provisions of this section, the provisions of this section on accountability shall not be subject to collective bargaining under Chapter 89. And that has become, as I say, the lightning rod, the focal point. A lot of agreement round and about that there needs to be accountability, a lot of support for the agenda, the standards agenda, the assessment agenda, the support agenda, and the accountability agenda. A lot of fear and concern about the possibility of arriving at those details any way other than through collective bargaining. I've had meetings. We are trying to work out something that can go into that placeholder that is satisfactory all around. I have been very, I hope, clear about what it is that concerns me about doing this through collective bargaining. I have been, I hope, very clear that the focus is on one issue and one issue only with respect to collective bargaining, and that for certain reasons and certain reasons only. I have identified 5 reasons that I think collective bargaining is not the right way to arrive at the details. But I've also been insistent and very serious throughout that we do need to collaborate on these details. We need to get all of the concerned parties together, and we need to work them out together. The issue of collaboration is not at issue from my standpoint. The issue of people coming to the table with genuine voice, meaning the ability to really influence the product, to build the product together, is not at issue in my view. What is at issue is whether or not collective bargaining is the right venue or the right forum process with which to accomplish that. There are reasons why I think it is not. 5 of them. Number 1, collective bargaining is fundamentally not collaborative. Collective bargaining is dominated by a quid pro quo logic in which 2 parties only come to the table to trade positions to arrive at the what some might call the least offensive compromise, or if you prefer, the best compromise resolution that satisfies most to the extent possible. That is not the same process as coming together to build something, to innovate. And so it's kind of, for me, the wrong process dominated by the wrong logic. The second concern, actually the second and third, are very closely related to each other. It turns out that under Chapter 89, collective bargaining is defined as a pairwise discussion, a dyadic exchange between an employer and an employee group. It's an exclusive conversation. It's a private conversation. And that means 2 things. My second concern, it means that multi-party activity is strictly prohibited under Chapter 89. Collective bargaining simply does not permit it. That's a concern to me because we need to build one system, one accountability system, one coherent accountability system. And we're unlikely to do that as a consequence of successive private conversations with different groups of people, each of whom have different interests to bring to the table. The only way you resolve multiple interests is through a process in which multiple parties get together and reconcile those interests. We got years and years of history that speaks to this. Every time we conclude an agreement with the teachers, the principals say, "Why did you put that in there?" And every time you conclude an agreement with the principals, the teachers say, "Why that?" And the only real answer to them is because you didn't get everybody together to build something. multiple party activity is just prohibited under collective bargaining. So you're not likely to get one system, and what we need is one accountability system, not an accountability arrangement between employer in this group and employer in that group and so forth and so on. You don't get a coherent system that way. There's a second outcome of the prohibition against multi-party activity, and that is, never mind the fact that you won't get all of the union groups together at once, you also won't bring to the table other people who I believe it's very important to have at the table at the accountability conversation. Everybody who's given testimony about accountability has reinforced, and I have accepted, or we've all agreed from the very beginning, that we need a genuine system of accountability, meaning accountability should not focus on one role group and one role group only. Accountability isn't achieved when you just do something to students, or when you just do something to teachers, or when you just do something to principals. And it isn't even achieved when all you look at is the education system itself. People have pointed out, and I agree, we ought to be thinking about and talking about accountability for parents, accountability for business community, for private philanthropic community, for political leadership, for media. And with some imagination, it's not impossible to think about things you could do that would do that. But here's the interesting thing. You will never do that if those people don't even have a place at the table. And they don't under collective bargaining. So that's reasons 2 and 3. The fourth reason is what I call the suppressor effect of ratification, meaning the people who come to the table under collective bargaining fundamentally don't have the authority to do a deal. What they have is the ability to work out a deal, and only that kind of a deal that can be sold to the rank and file. And that has a powerful suppressor effect on anyone's ability to truly innovate, to truly create. And that would be an issue. And the fifth and final reason is that if you do it through collective bargaining, at the end, the product goes into a contract where if you want to improve it, modify it at all, you do so subject to the same process that I've just described. So you could just repeat 1 through 4, right? And also where it is susceptible, this is the part that most disappoints me, it is susceptible to modification for irrelevant reasons. We see this all the time when you sit down to negotiate a new contract. Each party brings to the table things that it would like to work on. There are areas where you don't have the wherewithal to strike an agreement, so you turn to, okay, if you can't get something for us over there, how about something over here? We don't have the money for that for those health benefits we'd really very much like. How about we do something about that annoying little feature of the accountability system? My point is accountability needs to be different, it needs to be apart from, it needs to be sheltered from that kind of encroachment for unrelated concerns. I have no trouble reopening the accountability system and improving it. That should be done as an internal affair to the accountability system. Long story short, 5 reasons why I think collective bargaining isn't the right way to affect the kind of collaboration to build the kind of accountability system that we need. I am accepting of any solution, with or without collective bargaining, that addresses those 5 concerns. The other thing I've learned this year is that this year, with civil service reform, with the governor trying to roll back retirement benefits for public employees, with all kinds of things in the environment and climate, and with me trying to deal with one very particular issue for 5 very particular reasons, it turns out that this is the wrong year to try to maintain a subtle position. This is the wrong year to try to maintain a subtle or complex position about union affairs. Because the whole conversation has grown very polarized, unfortunately. There's a lot of misinformation, some misrepresentation. That's very unfortunate, because I dearly love dealing with tough issues on their merits. It is frustrating to see them dealt with for inaccurate or irrelevant concerns. But it has grown very polarized, in part because there are those who make of this an anti-teacher or anti-principal or anti-union matter. there are those who would make of the unions the reason for every disappointment that they have in public education. They're wrong. There are those, though, on the other side, the supporters of the union, who will make of this an anti-union matter because they think that they can motivate people better through fear than through inspiration. They are wrong. Or at least they're wrong to polarize, I think, the discussion in that way. But that's where we are. That bill has really pretty much sailed through. There is a House version and a Senate version. The House version is absolutely identical to what was introduced. The Senate version is also identical, except that instead of a blanket suspension of Act 89, what it does is it suspends with a sunset. A sunset of 3 years at this time. There's decision making in the final committee on the House side, actually today. It goes to the floor for the second reading sometime by next Thursday, and then it's headed to conference. I am very, very hopeful, mostly because of the way I approach problems like this, because I'm able to say these are the concerns. For me, it's not a lockdown position. Collective bargaining, yes. Collective bargaining, no. But instead, it is any solution that addresses these five concerns. And I can imagine solutions that can do that are perfectly acceptable to me. And so we'll continue to talk, and I'm hopeful that we can come up with language that that actually everybody could be satisfied with. But we shall see. What else? That's about it.
What about the supplemental budget? What do you? It doesn't look like you're going to get everything you asked for. So, anything in danger of not getting funded?
Yeah. The it's a weird it's a weird year that turned even weirder last week. We were having good conversations, really, with on the Senate side. Interestingly. Which is really working very, very hard to do as much as it can for education. They're working very hard to make of this the education session. And they were talking to us about, given some modest improvement in the economic picture, what things are really most important in turn to add to the governor's budget. The governor's proposal. And so we were having very good conversations, and then the issue of HDEA salaries came up, and even as we sit here, no one seems to have a great handle on exactly what the financial implications are there, so no one knows exactly whether this other stuff will be able to still stay in place. The governor's budget gave us $14 million new resources. The House version, virtually the same figure. I think it was half a million higher with some reallocation within the budget. The Senate was looking at, last I had heard, the governor's budget plus the possibility of trying to do something even more. And then, as I say, we're waiting now for another two or three days for things to sort themselves out to be able to say what's going on ultimately with respect to the budget.
But no one's near the 30.
No one's near 31.
31.
Yeah.
So is there anything that looks like may not get funded in this?
Well, there are definitely some things in the supplemental budget. You've already heard me say this, but the supplemental budget, first of all, it needs to be understood. The guidelines came to us around the supplemental budget, with the first guideline being that the bottom line should be zero, that it was to some... You could reallocate, but it was to sum to zero. Under any circumstance, and that was a reflection of the perception of the economy at that point in time, but under any circumstance, the supplemental budget is actually not an opportunity to go off with a wish list. It's not even, sad to say, an opportunity to go arguing for things that you might think you desperately need. The supplemental budget is defined and determined to be an opportunity to point out those real-world pipeline expenses. Maybe some things that were unanticipated when the biennial budget was put together, new obligations or changes in cost or whatever it might be. It is only for the purpose of addressing those sorts of obligations. Okay? And what we put together basically had three kinds of items in it. Number one, there was a number, I think it totaled close to $7 million in all. There was about $7 million in items that were funded in the first year of the biennium, but not the second. Okay? They were things like the so-called inclusion teachers, or the Every Child Counts initiative that we worked with HSTA to get passed, whereby special education students that are in mainstream classes get counted while they're there in the teacher allocation formula. That was funded in the first year, but not the second. And so if it was to be maintained, it had to be picked up at that point. There were items like that. There were about $7 million of them in all. They were funded in the first year, but not the second. And so obligations had been incurred. And so they went into the supplemental budget. Second item that was in there were new facilities about to open. Kapolei, Keau, and so on. Again, these are pipeline issues. The facility is there, it's about to open, it has to be fitted out, and it has to be staffed. The third item that was in there was a small amount of, I think the total was somewhere around $4 million in all, monies related to special education and Felix Matters. Those things are starting to actually taper off at this point, as revealed by our request, at least, for just $4 million. And that's all that was in there. That was all that was in there. The governor, as I said, the governor's package totaled about $14 million, so obviously there's a fair amount of stuff not covered. We went back to the governor. He gave us the opportunity to go argue for particular items that we thought he needed to appreciate how critical they might be. He listened well. He accepted a fair amount of what we spoke of, but there still leaves a pretty big gap. We're actually working with folks around that. Obviously, there are legislators trying to push something. The governor wants to see it happen. We want to see it happen. There's no question. Maile is number 9 on the priority list. Being number 9 doesn't mean that the situation isn't grave. It doesn't mean that the needs aren't great. What it means is that, incredibly, there are 8 others ahead of it. And I've been to half of those 8, and they're where they belong. Number 1 is King Cam 3 over in Lahaina. I don't know if you've ever been there, but it's right down on the boat harbor. It is not merely hot. It is immediately adjacent to where the tourist buses pull up and all day long pump diesel fumes and partially burned hydrocarbons into the classrooms. Now, pig and chicken dung stinks and is very unpleasant. Partially burned hydrocarbons are carcinogen. You tell me what belongs where on a priority list. And actually, that one's getting taken care of this year, which I'm grateful for. It takes $36 million to get down to number 9, and we get $1.7 million a year dedicated to that initiative. It's going to take some jumping to get to Maile, but there are indications that people want to do that, and I'm by no means reluctant to do it. What I won't do is I won't do it by rearranging the priority list. The priority list has to have some integrity, or no one will be able to trust it forevermore. So we're working with people to try to make it happen.
You talk about the reluctance to delegate authority. Is that stronger here than in other areas you're familiar with?
I don't. Sorry. Oh, yeah. I'm sorry, Diane. I'm not doing my thing. Is there more reluctance to delegate or relinquish authority here than in other places? At an individual and human level, no. And what I mean by that is, it's not like people here are any more control oriented, in my estimation. But there are excuse me. There are interesting things about our unique structure as a state system, for example, that does impinge upon this. And so I guess my answer to you is, as an assessment of the people involved, I don't detect any greater or lesser reluctance to delegate, to relinquish authority. I don't detect any greater or lesser urge to maintain control. The control instinct is probably just as great in the legislature, in the state of Pennsylvania, in the state of Delaware, in the state of Massachusetts, in New York. These are places where I've worked directly with the legislatures. What is different is that the legislature here has a direct connection and an authority over operations that doesn't exist in other places. And so the impact of it, I would say, is far greater. This is the only legislature in the country that, in debating the budget, is in effect debating the budgets of individual schools. Okay? I came in here full of enthusiasm about the potential of a unified system. And I use the word unified. I'm avoiding the use of the word centralized, of course. But I recognize our history is centralized, our tendencies, especially in moments of stress, are centralized. But I use the word unified to signal that it's worth thinking about what the potential of being one single, potentially coherent system might mean. There's immense potential in it. Anybody doing reform any place in the country knows that the biggest single challenge is consistency of message, understanding of message, and coherence in action. Pennsylvania has 501 school districts. The average school district in Pennsylvania has 18 schools in it. I don't know how many classes are in the average school, but that's all by way of saying that in every school in Pennsylvania, in every classroom in Pennsylvania, there is a teacher just wishing that the guy in the office and the guy downtown and the guy in the state capitol would all start to say the same thing so that she could do her work with some semblance of coherence and sanity. That dream is a dream you can actually dream here, because the guy in the office and the guy downtown and the guy in the state capitol actually are all the same people. I'm not saying we do it well enough yet, but that's the potential. The question is, how can you capitalize on that potential while not getting sucked into the pitfalls of centralization or dealing with some of the unique problems, the challenges that being one unitary state system means? And then I come back to what I said, because while I came in here full of enthusiasm about the potential of this system, and I still remain optimistic, I've also learned about some of the interesting challenges, like this is the only state where the legislature debates the curriculum of individual schools or the budgets of individual schools de facto. What happens in every other school district in the nation, our school state and every other system in the nation, is there is a good rollicking debate in the state capitol about education funding. How much can we afford to put in it? How much do we want to put in it? Where do we want to put it to back up our priorities? But once that debate is completed, that money goes off to something called the locally autonomous, politically independent school district, who then adds to it other resources, local property tax, federal revenues, and so forth and so on. So you have that debate, but once the debate is finished, that budget then is de facto a base. In Pennsylvania, again, just by way of reference, state funding averages, there are 501 districts and there's quite a range. State funding averaged from as high as 87% of all local of a local budget in one or two districts that I know of, to as low as 13%. It's a lot of independence. So the fact of the matter is, I don't detect at a human level that we have more control freaks than any place else. But we do have a structure that magnifies the impact of that control. You know, it's the only legislature. It's the only legislature. Or, I mean, this is the only state. I don't pick on the legislature. This is the only state in the country with job titles, job descriptions, job locations written into law. But it's also the only state in the country where you can, where you do that because of the structure of the system. It takes a lot of enlightenment, actually, to sit in the Capitol and say, to constrain those urges. But the urges aren't any greater than anywhere else.
Would you favor breaking up the DOE into autonomous county districts or some sort of breakup?
Not yet. Not until I'm convinced that this one can't work. I'm in favor of decentralization of authority. I'm in favor of decentralization of decision making. In that regard, I don't know that constitutes a breakup, but in that regard, we do need to relocate authority. There's no question about it. But I go back to what I said about the situation in Pennsylvania, the situation in every other state in the country, and I can tell you, it is well worth looking long and hard and knowing in our hearts that is so much better before you go to it, because it brings its own constellation of difficulties if you're trying to make improvement happen. And so, I'll just repeat what I said earlier on, which is I remain optimistic, and until I'm not optimistic anymore, and I'll actually change on the day that I'm not, but until I'm not optimistic anymore, I think the thing to do is to try to make this work, because the potential is worth trying to make it work.
Going back to the HGA raises, have you yet fathomed the kind of impact it could have on the department with the kind of numbers?
People are working on it right now, we haven't.
One other question. The other day there was a bill that passed on the principle that would allow the mainland, take away the requirement that prevents mainland principles becoming principles here.
Right.
Part of the discussion there, and I was just talking to somebody else, so I figured I'd ask you about it. If you can't get local people to become principals in areas, hard to place areas, like rural areas, neighbor islands, and some of the different areas, how would you expect a mainland principal without any kind of cultural sense to come in and take on those kinds of responsibilities too, and
maybe
you can talk a little bit about why you supported that bill.
Yeah. Well, we drafted, and I supported that bill actually for a very different reason, and that's worth noting, because many have related to it as some sort of stopgap emergency action given shortages, impending shortages, either through the system as a whole or in particular places around the state, and actually that wasn't the motive.
That's what they said at the meeting, at the hearing.
Yeah, well, and I'm not sure, to be honest with you, I'm not sure why, except that people sense that others respond to crisis better than, and so if you can say there's some crisis reason why this should be done, they feel it has stronger impact. But that actually wasn't the motive, and for others, let me just recap very quickly what the bill does, because what the bill does is so modest. It's very modest. Right now there is a requirement that anybody who is going to move into a principalship, in addition to having gone through a certification program, also must have met certain experiential requirements. One of them is that you have taught for at least 5 years, and the other is that at least one of those years has been in schools in Hawaii. Okay, that's it. That's the background experiential requirement around teaching. All this bill does was it leaves intact the requirement that you have 5 years teaching experience, but it says you don't have to have had that teaching experience be in Hawaii. And the whole point is that there are people who are potential principals for whom stepping back into the classroom at a certain point in their career, because they've been principals for many, many years, some of them, that stepping back into the classroom, I mean, imagine an individual with 15 years teaching experience and then 5 years as a principal, and darn good at all of it, to move back into the classroom for no reason other than the law says that one of those years must be in a classroom in Hawaii. Frankly, look at it and say, I'm not sure it is adding. If the whole point of an experiential background specification is to make certain that you have the right experience, I'm not sure it's adding to the experience that reasonably you would argue is absolutely necessary. Also in the certification process is a requirement that you apprentice in Hawaii schools. So to the extent to which the concern is, oh, but you've got to understand our unique cultural mix, our unique circumstance, et cetera, that's all well covered before you get there. So that's not the point. Teaching isn't the point. The guy I just spoke of has 15 years teaching experience. You've got to actually argue that teaching experience in San Francisco is so dramatically different than teaching experience in one of our schools that we need to see a year of teaching here. Not just a year in our schools here, which I do agree with, but a year of teaching here. Well, I actually just don't even buy it. So quite apart from any impending crisis, this just seemed like something that if you're relating to these things as minimum qualifications, it's an unnecessary qualification.
It's an exclusionary rule.
Excuse me?
I say it's an exclusionary rule.
Well, and it does have an exclusionary impact. It has an exclusionary impact, and of course, you know, there are those who are opposed to it. I haven't had real deep conversations with those who are opposed overly much, other than there's something gratifying about an exclusionary imposed exclusionary filter, and we hate to see those things removed. I don't know, you know. But to repeat, think for a moment about how modest that is as a change goes.
You have said that this was the wrong year to maintain a subtle position on union issues, and yet you say your accountability bills are making progress. I gather, despite very determined resistance by the unions. How do you explain this? Is there a sudden conversion where the legislators are becoming independent of union pressure, resistant to union pressure?
Well, they haven't gone all the way to the point of voting it from bill to act yet, that's for sure. I think that the legislature is impressed with the importance of the issue. I believe that the legislature very much wants to see something meaningfully done in this regard. And I think that they have, to this point at least, marshaled all of the courage necessary to keep something moving along. I think the legislature would also very much like to see us be able to present to them a happy resolution to this very difficult issue. I'd very much like to do that, and we'll work very hard to do that, and I hope we can do that. But the best answer to why it's come along this far is because the need has a compelling quality to it in and of itself, because beyond the play numbers, but because beyond the 12,000 or 15,000 members of the immediately concerned unions and the 15,000 more to whom they're married or related, there are around 400,000 other voters in the state. And if the numbers out of this recent poll can be taken to be at all accurate, about 240,000 of them, well, let me back up. Somewhere around 280,000 of them favor this, and about 240,000 of them favor doing this in some way other than the way in which we've traditionally done it. And so that doesn't make the legislator's job any easier. it makes it even more difficult, perhaps. And so what I know that they very much would like to do is to see us come to a happy solution all around, and I hope that we can do that. But I think they've moved it this far along because the issue is an important one. The necessity for it is absolutely compelling, and they, to this point at least, can't and have not shirked from that need.
What about the fact that the bills have been moving along? Has the union lobbying stepped up?
Oh, yeah.
Have you seen it? And
oh, yeah.
In what sense?
It's increasing. Well, you know, when they had their annual meeting, it sort of, I think, gave them an opportunity to get together, talk to each other, listen to leaders. And from that point forward, you've seen a lot more increase. You see people at board meetings giving testimony. You see folks talking directly to legislators. I'm sure I hear from legislators. As I understand it, they're planning a rally for some time late this month. I mean, those are all things that I've seen or heard tell of.
It sounds like the testimony, the rhetoric and the testimony has kind of stepped up. Is that what you talked about earlier about the polarization?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I was out last evening at a town meeting over in Kaneohe, and a large number of teachers and administrators came out. Union folks had put out a flyer that the purpose of all this was to drive us back to the plantation days, and therefore they needed to come out and show their support and voice their concerns. And it really is quite remarkable how much misinformation and misunderstanding I ran into when I talked to folks out there. Folks have been told, and folks have come to be of the opinion that what is being suspended is the contract. You know, let me be very, very clear. Even under the worst case from a union perspective, what that bill says is that the details of the accountability system will be worked out through a process other than collective bargaining. That's exactly what it says. That's all that it says. It doesn't say the contract is suspended. It doesn't say that seniority, tenure, transfer rights are completely out the window. But that's what I'm, you know, that's what I'm hearing. That's what folks are telling each other, either out of sincere fear or because fear motivates. What I'm a little bit concerned of is the relationship is important, and it's important on into the future. And there is one very unfortunate, potentially very negative impact of this, and that is when we get a happy resolution of this, one wonders about the extent to which all of that unfortunate rhetoric stains the situation even after you've resolved it. That would be something you'd be very willing to live with if the rhetoric were accurate and fair. It's very unfortunate, and it doesn't serve teachers well if that happens and that rhetoric is not accurate.
You're saying right now it's not accurate.
I'm saying a lot of it isn't. Mm-hmm. It could well be sincere misunderstanding. That's what fear will do.
So how do you get them to the table to collaborate on accountability if you have these strained relationships?
Well, that's exactly the question. You know, at the day after you pass the law and you send out the call that says, now let's work together. Just last evening, you know, somebody said to me in the question and answer part of this thing, somebody said, and this was somebody who I know, so a teacher I know, very, very good teacher, very, very supportive of rigor and quality in the classroom. I know this for a fact. And also very, not the least bit fearful of accountability, but said, why do you have to, why must you take away the only instrument that gives me equal footing with my employer? And my answer was, it may be the only instrument that gives you equal footing with the employer now. It is not the only instrument that one can imagine. That's what this conversation is about. This conversation is not about whether you should have equal footing in that conversation. This debate is about whether or not that's the only way to do it. I suspect that collective bargaining has come to be the only way that you have equal standing in the conversation, because up to this point, the relationship has been a very disrespectful one. And if it's disrespectful, then that kind of power instrumentation is the only way to get equal footing. But shame on those who've crafted a disrespecting relationship. Try to engage in the thought experiment of imagining a very different relationship, and then think about all the other things that become possible. That's what this debate's about. And then the answer, of course, that you always hear at that point is, well, we trust you, but what about if you're not here? What if you get hit? The recent concern in legislative testimony hearings has been that I'm likely to be hit by a bus. So I've been taking care.
What do you see as a compromise going into the conference committee?
Well, that's hard to speculate, but if you go back to my five things, you can imagine what it would be. I mean, think of each other. Let's deal with just the last one, just by way. Well, I mean, the top one. The top one says, it's a process dominated by quid pro quo logic. Well, you can address that just by a different process, some multi-party process that is, in fact, genuinely collaborative. I define genuine collaboration as common goals, shared values, equal power, and real work to do. So you put together a different process. It's a multi-party process that has those attributes, and you've just taken care of 1, 2, and 3 on my list. But as a technical matter, that process turns out not to be collective bargaining. That's my only point. It's a small technical matter, but...
You're saying it's a multi-party process that brings together more people than just a single bargaining unit.
Exactly. Right? Exactly. Exactly.
Okay.
Do we know how... Is Hamamoto your number one assistant? Or she's up there somewhere.
She's my number one equal.
Your number one
equal? Yeah, she is.
I had some exposure to her at McKinley High School when she was there.
Mm-hmm.
If she could do for the school system what she did for McKinley, you're all set.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. I'm grateful every day, as a matter of fact, for Pat.